Let's talk with our resident historian, John Schmidt, former high school teacher who's the writer of the book Hidden Chicago Landmarks. Talks about some of the history that is in hidden view, sometimes right in front of our eyes, but takes a little bit of sleuthing to figure it out. And John Schmidt is just the guy to do it. He joins us every month. John, great to see you, man.
Good to be here. And you're talking about being in front of everybody's eyes. Now, any of us that grew up on the north side of Chicago knew about this place that we're mentioning today, but maybe some of the people down south didn't know about it, at least until recently. It's been in the news
recently. That's right. The first place we're going to talk about, and I mentioned it just at the beginning, is the Leaning Tower of Niles. Now, you have all sorts of things in your Hidden Chicago Landmarks, and this is one that doesn't seem that hidden because people who know Niles and know the area are very familiar with this story, but it was just added to the National Register of Historic Places just in the last couple of weeks. What is the, if you're not familiar, what is the Leaning Tower of Niles?
Well, it's on Toohey Avenue at 6300 West Toohey, and it's in Niles, and it's a half-size replica of the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
That's it.
And the way it got started with a man by the name of Robert Ilg, I-L-G. And early 20th century, he came up with an improved motor for electric fans and things of that sort. And he opened a factory in Chicago at 2850 North Crawford Avenue. That's Pulaski Road now. And he did very well. Well, in the 1930s, 1931, I believe was the date, he decided he was going to build a picnic grove, park, for his employees so they could have some relaxation.
Right. Everyone needs relaxation.
Yeah, and he went out to Niles. He found a site, Niles, and he was going to build, according to the usual story, he's going to build a swimming pool there, and he needed someplace for the water tanks. So he's a scientist, Robert Ilg was, and he's an admirer of Galileo. And, you know, of course, Galileo had dropped the dropped a couple balls down from the Leaning Tower of Pisa to do an experiment. And so Robert Ilg decides he's going to build a replica of the Leaning Tower of Pisa to disguise these water tanks. And he
That's really what it was for? It was to disguise water tanks for a pool?
Basically, that's what it was.
I never knew that. That's great.
No, and you see, the thing is, the Leaning Tower of Pisa was built several hundred years ago, but 12th century, 13th century, whenever it was. And it leaned because they messed up on it. But when Ilg built his tower, he wasn't going to build a straight-up tower. So he actually had to hire some people, some engineers from San Francisco that had to do a lot of calculations so they could put a lean in it and not make it dangerous. And that's what they did. They make sure the lean was going to be constant, they put a cement foundation in. And the interesting thing about this, I didn't mention this in the book, but I thought later, Robert Ilg's factory was, it's 2850 North Pulaski as it is. Right next door to him was the Olson Rug Company. And when Robert Ilg opened his park for his employees in 1931, people at Olson Rug decided they were going to make a park for their employees, too. But they had room on their grounds, and so they made a park for their employees, which was very famous for many years because they had a waterfall there and everything. But anyway, that's just an aside.
Do you think that has anything to do with the competition? Do you think that Ilg might have been like, you know what, you take your waterfall, I'm going to do a replica of the Leaning Tower of Pisa?
Well, the Leaning Tower was there first.
Oh, that was there
Olson,
first.
Olson,
oh, Olson stole
Olson
the idea.
Captured him. maybe not.
Even
anyway,
better, even better.
Anyway. Getting back to the tower. The tower was completed in 1934, 94 feet tall, 28 feet at the diameter, and it's tilt 7.4 degrees. And they hung five bells in there. And unlike the one in Pisa, they got steel and concrete in holding it up. And for the next quarter century, the employees of his company, the Ilg Hot Air Electric Ventilating Company, used it, and during the same time, the YMCA began using the
property. Right, that's how I know it. But yeah.
Well, in 1958, the YMCA workers, they raised $54,000 to help renovate the inside of the tower, and the Skokie Valley YMCA had established its headquarters at the site, and the Y put money in. They built an athletic field and a skating rink, campgrounds. Well, in 1960, after Robert Ilg died, his heirs gave the tower and the surrounding land to the YMCA.
Oh, okay.
And the tower was, the idea was the tower was to be maintained for a period of 99 years, minimum $500 spent each year on upkeep. So YMCA took charge of it, and they opened a YMCA facility there called the Leaning Tower YMCA, believe it or not. Well, meanwhile, Ilg's monument is attracting special sort of attention. And I remember when I was young, I used to hear stories. People would land at O'Hare, and they'd have a they have a layover at O'Hare, maybe 3 or 4 hours or something like that. People would actually hop in a cab.
No way.
Well, security is a lot.
Yeah, they could jump out and come back.
In those days, they hop in a cab. They take a cab over to Toohey Avenue. It's only 7, 8 miles, I guess, 10 at the most maybe. Take a few pictures of it. Send it to the, you know, bring it back to the folks back home, you know, and say, hey, where's where I was? And, you know, they throw around a story. Maybe somebody got fooled by it. I don't know. But anyway, of course, you can't do that now.
No.
Not if you're late over.
No, you have to go back. Exactly.
Anyway, well, meanwhile, you got to figure, where is filtering back to the city of Pisa that some crazy American has built a leaning tower? So, Niles officials along the way in the 1960s, they started pursuing a sister cities agreement with Pisa. Well, Pisa's kind of wary.
They don't like it.
Wait a minute. What is this Niles, Illinois? We don't know what Niles, Illinois is. Why would somebody build a leaning
tower? They're stealing our architecture.
Well, you know, anyway, finally what happened in 1991, they sent some people from Pisa, came over to Niles, and the Niles officials showed them around. And said, well, Niles is a nice place, you know, obviously we know that. And the people from Pisa were convinced, and so they agreed to sister cities agreement. So anyway, in the meantime, they were having trouble with the leaning tower in Pisa. And in Pisa, they had to put money into the tower to fix it up. And in 1995, the village in Niles had to come in and kick in some money because the tower in Niles was having difficulty. And they fixed up the grounds and so on. More years went by. 2014, they did a new study. And they figured the Niles tower needed more repairs. So anyway, the city of Niles figured out this has become the symbol of their town. So they kicked in some more money, and they also purchased the tower, the city of Niles did, for a token $10 from the YMCA. And by that time, $750,000 had been put into it.
Oh, my gosh.
And then, of course, the bells over there. And while they were doing this restoration work in 2017, somebody discovered the bells were hundreds of years old. Nobody knew where these bells came from. But anyway, it's been written up in the Tribune and other places lately with the sister cities agreement, and then of course being put on national register,
and the bells are back
and you can drive down Toohey Avenue, you can see it, and I understand they're going to open it to the public in a few years, so that would be fun.
That's amazing. I've always thought it was more of a, I don't know, like a tourist tchotchke thing, like a kind of like a hacky, hey, you like it in Pisa, you like it here. I had no idea about the history
of it. This
is
not Las Vegas.
It's very Las Vegas.
We're in Chicago and Chicago suburbs. So
this is not Vegas.
You want that?
This
you can go Niles, to Las Vegas right. And see all that stuff.
The book is Hidden Chicago Landmarks. The author, John Schmidt, he joins us every month here to talk about history. We've got more stories coming up here right after the break, so stay with us. 312-981-7200. Quick programming note. Tomorrow will be Super Tuesday 2, I guess is what they're calling it, John. But we'll be on the air, and we'll give you results, and we'll talk about what comes of the closest state to Illinois, which would be Michigan. Right now, the exit polls in Michigan say that Joe Biden has a sizable lead over Bernie Sanders. But tomorrow will go a long way to understanding what role the state of Illinois and the next Tuesday will mean for the Democratic primary. That's all coming up tomorrow night here on 720 WGN. Right now, John Schmidt is here, our resident historian. He's the author of Hidden Chicago Landmarks, which is really about the landmarks that are missing from the usual tours. You're a former high school teacher and
high school, grade school, college, everything.
You've done it all. You've done it all, John. When you think about this, I mean, the idea of taking this on, it was to put all these stories together. How long did it take you to do this? And, you know, when you look back and we've been talking about these stories for the last couple of months, does it amaze you how much work it went into this?
No, it's how I actually got started with the one we're talking about now. 1978, I bought my first house. And that was in Oak Park. If you know anything about Oak Park, this was south of the expressway. This is on Winona Avenue, practically at Roosevelt in Harlem.
Okay.
The snobs on the other side of the expressway call that North Berwyn, but you know, it's what I could afford. And on this
north of the expressway snobs.
I had a nice house on Winona Avenue, a stucco house. But down the block in the corner, there was this house, brick house, with this roof at the top with the tiles and everything. Mm. It was huge, beautiful house. And I wondered, that house is what got me started working on it, because finally I asked somebody, you know, whose house, you know, what about the story about the house? And he said, well, that was Sam Giancana's house.
Mm.
And if anybody doesn't know, Sam Giancana was the head of the Chicago Outfit for a while, the head of the syndicate. This house, you know, Oak Park today, it's got three historic districts, dozens of historic buildings. There's no plaque or anything on this bungalow at the northwest corner of Winona and Fillmore, because that's where Giancana lived. That's where he died. So, you know, I was surprised to hear about that. And he said, Sam Giancana? And the neighbor said, oh, yeah, you know, he didn't bother us. We sure didn't bother him, you know. But anyway, the story.
And what was so great about the house? What was it?
It was just a beautiful house. Yeah. This picture of it, and, you know, it looks like something from the North Shore. And, you know, it, as I said.
Along the bungalows in South Oak Park.
Yeah. Well, along the frame house. It's a bungalow, but it's a beautiful bungalow. Beautiful bungalow, big and so on. Anyway, he was killed in the basement, but we're getting ahead of the story. Anyway, Giancana was born in the Italian settlement, Taylor Street, 1908. And there are all kinds of different sources say what his birth name was. Anyway, he became known as Sam Giancana. And he put together a neighborhood gang when he was a teenager. And in 1925, he caught the eye of the recruiters for the Capone mob, because Sam, besides being a tough guy, he knew how to drive a car, and he knew how to drive a car very well. And in 1925, that was a needed skill, fast car driver for, you know, whatever.
Much needed.
Other people did not afford. So anyway, after he served his apprenticeship, he started working his way up in the gang, and he was arrested a number of times and never made it stick. In 1933, he got married. He moved into a flat, three flat, on the west side of Lexington Street. Well, he continued climbing the gangland organizational ladder, and we can use our imagination.
Are you getting this from his LinkedIn page? It feels like it's not. I'm joking.
No. His daughter wrote a book called Mafia Princess, but that's
different. Okay.
Anyway, he's moving.
I'm just
up
here for humor, John. I'm just here to interject some humor. Go ahead, your turn.
Well, keep going. keep interjecting. We need it.
My LinkedIn comedy.
Anyway, Sam served a prison sentence. World War II came. He was rejected for military service. And I should quote why he was rejected. He was rejected for, quote, constitutional psychopathic state and inadequate personality manifested in strong antisocial tendencies. So they did not want him for a warrior in World War II, because they couldn't control him, I guess.
Wow, that's great. I mean, you'd think in World War II they'd be taking everybody for the big war.
They got to worry whether you're going to shoot at the right people.
Right, exactly.
Anyway, by now Giancana had three daughters. So April 1945, he's looking for a better place. So he buys this bungalow. The bungalow was already there, 1147 South Winona, paid $32,000. That's about almost half a million today. And he paid cash. Well,
of course he did, yeah.
Yeah, family joined St. Bernardine's Parish, where my kids were baptized, by the way, and I was in Forest Park. And Sam wasn't seen at Mass very often, but his daughter said he gave an altar rail to the church. And I don't know if that was still there when we were there. Anyway, he was devoted to his wife, Angeline, but didn't stop him from becoming involved with other women. And Mrs. Giancana died in 1954. Sam never remarried. But then, in the 1960s, Sam becomes the public face of the outfit. He's moved up. In the 1960 election, one of the legends is Giancana and the boys supposedly stole enough votes to swing the election to Kennedy. So the idea is when Kennedy administration came in, they began cracking down on organized crime, Giancana was double-crossed. And that scenario claims that, well, when Kennedy was assassinated, he was actually a mob hit because they were mad at him.
Right.
So anyway, he was also rumored to be part of a CIA plot to kill Castro. Well, what happened there is they couldn't get close to Castro, so they come up with an alternate plan. They were going to put this substance in Castro's drinks that would make his beard fall out, and that would embarrass him. So, people can't see us. Justin and I both have beards, so we can identify with
this. It
would
be very embarrassing.
Yes,
it would be very embarrassing.
Anyway, that never worked anyway. And whatever the truth, you know,
if I were a head of state, if I were a communist head of state, that would be very embarrassing.
Well, Castro kept power. He kept his beard,
right.
too. So anyway.
Didn't work.
He had his lady friends. He was involved with one of the McGuire sisters singers. He also had a mistress called Judith Campbell Exner. She was also one of JFK's mistresses.
This is Giancana, of course.
Yeah, Giancana. And so who knows what that was about. Anyway, 1965 was jailed for refusing to testify before a grand jury. But they released him. So he was getting too much of a high profile. In organized crime, they basically told him, Sam, go off somewhere. We don't need you in the paper all the time. So he went off to Mexico, and he kept the house in Oak Park, and it just kind of sat there for a long time. So in 1974, the feds brought him back to U.S. to question him about something else. And he was scheduled to appear before a Senate subcommittee. But then, June 19th, 1975, he was killed in his basement. Somebody shot him in the back. He was frying some sausage at a stove, and he evidently trusted the guy or woman that killed him, but of course was never discovered. And it was a funny thing. After I bought the house in Oak Park.
In 78, you said?
Yeah, 78. You know, I remembered the killing, of course. And I asked the people more about Sam Giancana, and they said, well, we actually miss having him in the neighborhood because the FBI had him under 24/7 surveillance outside the house.
So they're
always
police.
And with the FBI there, it was much safer in the neighborhood with those FBI guys there. So,
and constant police in your neighborhood. Yeah,
yeah. Well, I lived there 9 years later, and when I sold the house finally and moved to a different place, I did not advertise it was close to Giancana's, but I suppose people know it now.
You didn't say steps to public transportation, steps to Giancana?
Well, I had a jewel behind me, so that was convenient.
The jewel is a better sell than
yes, it was.
Same
yes,
block
it was.
As Sam Giancana's house. A great story. One more? You got one more in you?
Sure.
Let's take a break here, and then we'll come back. Hidden Chicago Landmarks is the book. John Schmidt is the author. He joins us once a month to tell some stories of some of the unusual stories that are missing from the usual tours. We'll take a quick break and come back with John Schmidt. Stay with us. Justin Kaufman here, 720 WGN. Our phone number, 312-981-7200. Coming up, Mark Conkle's going to join us to talk a little bit about his column he wrote at the end of last week about what if there wasn't somebody, a CTA writer, who videotaped the altercation with the two police officers and the man resisting arrest. Where would we be in this investigation? And does the fact that it was videotaped by a third party actually suggest that the police may want to rethink the way that they release videos for the public to see when there are altercations like that? We'll have that conversation coming up a little bit later in the program. And Chris Jones is here as well, from the Chicago Tribune. We're going to talk about some of the theater fare, including Some Like It Hot, the announcement today that the classic Broadway musical is back. It's going to be on stage as a pre-Broadway tryout here in Chicago before it hits New York. We'll talk about that and about coronavirus fears when it comes to going to the theater. That's all coming up a little bit later, 312-981-7200. John Schmidt is here. He's our resident historian. He's also the author of the book Hidden Chicago Landmarks. I was just thumbing through, John, and I feel like, and you can find these at WGNradio.com, our segments. We've talked about a lot of the chapters in your book. It's really fun to look and talk about Walt Disney's birthplace or the Balbo Column or who's buried in Logan's tomb. We actually went out to the tomb. I've done a lot of these stories, the cow path and the loop. A lot of good stuff.
Oh, yeah. I just finished the next one. I'm sending it to the publisher, so maybe 4 or 5 months, I'll have another one out.
Oh,
so.
That's great. That's awesome. Okay, well, that's good to know. Well, let's talk about the cover, because on the cover of your book, The Hidden Chicago Landmarks, there's an old sign. It's an old Chicago lager beer sign, and it says Peter Hand Brewing Company. Let's start there.
Well, it's funny how things get put on the cover of a book. Because the Peter Hand Brewing Company is now no longer there. I have 10 lost landmarks in the book besides 42, I think it is, current landmarks, mm-hmm. and 10 drive-by neighborhoods. But anyway, they figure it's going to sell the book because it's a nice picture, and it did sell at least one book. My wife, Terry, is a psychotherapist. One of her clients was in there, and they were talking about Chicago history, and she said, oh, I get this great book because it had this picture of the brewery on the front, and I had to buy the book.
The buyer,
and
right.
And she
Your publisher was right, John.
She was very surprised that my wife was my wife. Anyway.
You could have put anything on the cover, but it was that one.
No, they put it on the cover. The publisher put it on the cover. They know that better than I do. All I can do is write the stuff.
We have all kinds of
microbreweries around. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
This is the last macrobrewery the city had. And goes back to Peter Hand. He was a Prussian-born brewer, and he was in the Union Army during the Civil War, came to Chicago, got a job working for another brewery. 1891, he opens his own brewery in the German community at North and Sheffield, and he calls his beer Meisterbrau, which means master brew. Well, 1899, he died, but his brewery survived. And 1920, Prohibition came, and it was officially closed, but, you know. Anyway, 1933, when repeal came, they were back in business very quickly, rebounded for some reason. Anyway, business was good. The plant expanded, and most of the small neighborhood breweries had died by then, but there were still some left. Like on the north side, besides Peter Hand, there was Tavern Pale Dry. And the west side, you had Fox Deluxe Beer, Monarch Beer, Southside, Atlas, Prager, Edelweiss Breweries. You also had the Manhattan Brewing Company, and their beer was Canadian Ace, and that was the Mobs Brewery. Anyway, my dad hated Canadian Ace beer. But
I've never heard of Canadian Ace beer.
Well, it was gone out of business before I was old enough to drink, but my dad was a connoisseur of beer, so if he said it was bad...
It was bad.
It was bad. I mean, he said they should have left in the horse.
I take your dad's...
During the 1950s, the beer industry began changing, and all these little small breweries started going out of business. National breweries are advertising more and so on. 1965, a group of investors bought the Peter Hand Brewery, and they figured they're going to go national. So they sink all kinds of money into it. They buy two more old shuttered breweries in Toledo and San Francisco, and they start aggressively marketing. They got... bottle openers, beer steins, coasters, broadcasts. They sponsored the Sox and the Bulls and the Blackhawks. And somebody said, gee, there were almost as many Meisterbrau billboards around town as there were billboards reading Elect Daily for Mayor. But anyway, the brewery. Now, here's one that should resonate with you, Justin. The brewery also sponsored a radio program on WGN.
Okay.
Was called the All Night Meisterbrau Showcase, and was hosted by a man by the name of Franklin McCormick, and it ran six nights a week, 11:05 p.m. through 5:30 a.m. And Franklin McCormick, we blended this light music. He read poetry. He read stories. It was ultimate easy listening. And a late hour broadcast, and the power of WGN's superstation men went all over to east places where Meisterbrau wasn't sold. And I can testify to that. I used to, when I was in college, I'd go up to Boston, and we lose WGN when you got around Cleveland. But then if it was at night, you get to Rochester, you'd pick up WGN again, and you'd listen to WGN all the way to when you got to around Albany or so. And Franklin McCormick would be on, and he was very kind. He didn't put me to sleep, but I was just, you know, it was a little bit of home.
Right.
Well, anyway... the brewery was very happy about this. People were even coming into Chicago, and they had heard Meisterbrau broadcast and Franklin McCormick. They'd bring home a six-pack of Meisterbrau. It was like a souvenir of Chicago. Anyway, the company, what they really hit it big with, 1967, they introduced Meisterbrau Light.
Oh, yeah,
now,
of course.
They did not invent it. There was a brew called Gablinger's Diet Beer was the first real light beer. But Meisterbrau Light is the one that really popularized, and it took off, and the brewery was soon adding all kinds of products in their light banner, party dips, dry roasted peanuts, you name it. And at first, it seemed the expansion was working. The brewery was getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but they overextended. And then, of course, 1971, Franklin McCormick had a heart attack on the air.
On the air.
He had a heart attack on the air. They had to take him off to the hospital, and he died in the hospital. He did not die.
He did not die in the
broadcast booth. But anyway, that was kind of an omen, I guess, because 1972, the brewery's really in bad shape. They sold their brands, including that light label, to Miller Brewing in Milwaukee. And that's where Miller Brewing gets the light label. 2 weeks later, the brewery goes into bankruptcy. But in spring of 1973... an experienced Wisconsin brewer comes and he buys the plant, and they're going to resurrect it. And they resurrect the old name, Peter Hand Brewery, and they come up with this old Chicago beer, and old Chicago dark, won a bunch of blind taste tests. And by that time, I was old enough to drink. It was pretty good, old Chicago dark, actually, but they couldn't compete with the Nationals, and they closed 1978. And today, the property is a strip mall. But I managed to take a picture of it when it was still in business. And
it's a strip mall now.
It's a strip mall.
Where is it at again?
It's at the northwest. It was at the northwest corner of North Avenue in Sheffield. Mm. Is where it was.
And that I mean, right in North Avenue in Sheffield, that's going to be where your Whole Foods is at now.
Oh yeah, Whole Foods.
The strip mall. It's funny because that strip mall you're talking about, which had it used to have a Whole Foods in there and the Best Buy, that had a bookstore in the middle of there called Transitions Book Place, and I worked there in college.
So I
was right in the middle of Peter Hand Brewery and had no idea, which is probably why I drank so much in college. Doubtful. John, always great. What a great story. Thanks so much. Great stories tonight. The book is called Hidden Chicago Landmarks. Our resident historian, John Schmidt, joins us once a month to talk about some of the stories that are in the book. He's got a new book coming out soon, so we're going to have more stories to talk about. But just always a pleasure to have you on the program, John.
Always
thanks for coming.
Always a pleasure to be here.